Joining us today from Zurich, Switzerland, our guest, Marcello La Rocca, has held down a large variety of roles in the software industry over the years, including full stack engineer, data visualization engineer, back-end engineer, game programmer, and most recently, applied research engineer. Marcello has held these roles at companies like Microsoft, SwiftIQ, Twitter, and Apple. Marcello has even taught computer science in high school on two different occasions. As if that's all not enough, in addition to his day job, he is a prolific blogger and the author of Manning Publications, Algorithms and Data Structures in Action. Be sure to keep listening as we research Marcello La Rocca's career to find out what lessons he's learned. Manning Publications has been helping developers and data scientists keep their skills up to date for over 20 years now. This veteran publisher is known for producing some of the very best tech content you can buy. Manning's catalog of books, video courses, and practical hands-on live projects is always updating and covers everything from programming languages to career development. Why not check out Algorithms and Data Structures in Action by today's guest, Marcello La Rocca. This easy-to-understand book teaches you optimal algorithms to solve common programming challenges and keep your code fast, efficient, and reliable. You'll find Marcello's book and more by going to manning.com. Use the coupon code PODDEVMEN20, that's PODDEVMEN20, to get 40% off your cart at checkout. Happy reading!
You're listening to the Developmentor podcast, hosted by Grant Ingersoll. We have one goal on the show, to help you build a successful career in tech, no matter where you're from or where you're going. We do this by showcasing interesting people working across a variety of roles in tech and deep dive into their why. If you want to learn more, please visit our website at developmentor.com or follow us on Twitter at developmentor.
Hey, Marcello. Great to have you on the show. Thanks so much for joining me.
Hi, Grant. It's a pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, and I trust you are doing well. I believe so. We were just chatting offline. You're currently in Italy, but from Zurich. Is that right? Like you're kind of going back and forth?
Yes, that's right.
Yeah, that's fantastic. Well, and hopefully all is well there for you, given all that's been going on in the world. I know it's been tough times, especially if Northern Italy was pretty hard hit with all of this, right?
Yeah, unfortunately, also right now the numbers, the contagion is going back up a little bit, so it's a bit worrisome.
Yeah, for sure, especially as we head into fall and winter months. I know that's definitely on the top of my mind here in the U.S. as well. So, but I appreciate you very much taking the time to join me, and I'd love to dive in here. You know, I mean, from the looks of your profile, you started pretty early in tech, getting right into it at university, getting a master's in computer science. I would love to hear about those early years of what inspired you to get into tech.
To be honest, like actually, I started earlier. I started in high school because maybe it's funny. I didn't want to study Latin, and so I chose a particular class in high school where instead of Latin, we were studying computer science, basically. Before that, I never thought I would, start programming or learn programming, and that's quite funny and strange because my father was working in computer science. But anyway, once I started with Turbo Pascal back then, I never stopped.
Love it. That was my first language as well. So this is so interesting. We've had on at least two other guests who were Latin majors who then got into computer science. You got into computer science because you wanted to avoid Latin. Is that right?
Yes, that's right. I mean, I have nothing against Latin. It's a beautiful language and it's nice if you want to study it and you want to learn it. But I just thought like it would be more useful in a way or to study English and computer science than Latin for me.
Yeah, for sure. Although, you know, you're right in the home of Latin these days, so you got to be careful what you say, right?
You know, you can't imagine the arguments about Latin, studying Latin or not studying Latin here. It's something I pretty strongly felt.
Yeah, well, and I think it still is helpful these days to have at least some basis in Latin just for being able to learn and understand how language works. So there's definitely that side of it. But that's an interesting one too, though. Your father was a computer scientist, and yet you didn't really feel that pull so much in high school, right?
Yeah. Before high school, I was used to be around computers since I was very young, probably in primary school. And when I was 8, I had my first mocked computer that was only running BASIC, and I was typing some BASIC for some very easy programs. But I really didn't get how cool it was since high school.
What inspired you? You know, so you go off to university and you go straight into a 5-year, as I understand it, master's program. What inspired you to get the master's right off the bat?
Yeah, there was no choice up to 2001 in Italy. You had to go for a 5-year degree.
Gotcha. Very cool. Because, you know, like I sometimes see people go back and get a master's, but I know like different countries have different setups in terms of universities. So that makes sense. Well, then you've done your 5 years, you've got your computer science degree. What was your career mindset as you were graduating university? Like, how were you thinking about entering the work world, and how has that evolved over the years?
Well, actually, that's a very good question. Also, because my mindset changed a few times. While I was studying, I thought I would stay in academia. Like, I would start a PhD likely and follow that path. Then a couple of things happened. On one end, I thought, after graduating, I wouldn't mind having an actual working experience. Also because back then we didn't have any traineeship as part of our course of studies. Basically, we were graduating without any experience, any work experience, unless you were doing it as a side after or in parallel with university. But that would also mean, or would also have meant, to slow down your studies. When I was about to graduate, basically, I was a little bit late on my schedule. I was up to graduate on the very first chance, at the end of the 5 years. But I got caught up a little bit with my thesis, and I decided to wait and to improve it a little bit. And when I finished, when I was ready to graduate, it was December, and for that year, I could not apply for a PhD anymore. After that, and before the next PhD class started, I had the chance to work as a trainee at the European Commission. I didn't want to miss this chance. Probably because of that, I started a different path. Anyway, I was in Brussels for this traineeship in the IT department of the press bureau at the European Commission for a little bit less than a year. And when I came back to Italy, my idea of what would my career would be was still a bit fuzzy, right? Also because I was not yet ready to think globally in a way. I was more thinking of the job landscape in Italy. And to be honest, it was not that great. Most software engineers' job in Italy are about consultancy and working as a contractor for usually something related with publicly owned company or government owned companies. It's quite different from what you experience in the job market worldwide, and what I experienced myself once I left Italy. By that time, I was really into gaming, and I thought I wanted to work in the game industry. And so I started for Milestone as a game developer and software engineer. And I sat there for a bit, not too long, actually. Most of my early career was, you know, was about web development anyway, and also a bit about teaching.
Well, so then you mentioned too that your kind of your approach to your career has changed. How has it changed? Obviously, I think you mentioned, you know, you had to shift towards more of a global view of work, but what else changed about how you approached your career?
As I said, like the idea of what you could do as a software engineer was quite different. Also back then, we were just out of the first IT bubble burst. For example, Google or even Amazon were really young companies, and the kind of job you can have today working for a startup or for a company like it's Google, Facebook, or Twitter, it was not something that was conceivable for me. So most of the jobs available in Italy were around data warehouse, handling standalone applications for small companies to manage their storage or their operations. There were like a couple of companies like IBM or Microsoft, but they felt like quite difficult to get into, especially if you didn't want to go abroad to move from Italy. And that was my case back when I started.
What inspired you to leave Italy? Was it like that experience in Brussels working for the European Commission, or was there something else that finally pushed you over the edge to say, I'm going to get out of Italy, I'm going to go work somewhere else?
Yeah, partially it was my experience at the European Commission, because like there it was at the same time a blessing and a curse starting in a position like that and then going back to Italy, because the level was so high and the work was organized and developers were seen. It was completely different from what I had found back in Italy. I was aware that there was something different and something better abroad. And at the same time, it was a different awareness about the kind of job and the kind of technologies I could have worked on in those 6 years, I guess, that passed between my experience there and when I started looking for jobs abroad. I had learned much more about web applications. I had become proficient in JavaScript. I had started using internet and social networks more to get an understanding of the global landscape of what was available. And I also understood better what I wanted for my career. Before starting with SwiftIQ and then Twitter, in the meantime, I had gotten this job at INPS, which is a government-owned company in Italy. It's like one of those jobs in Italy for which people would kill, I mean, figuratively. Like it's a very stable position. If you want to, and for most people it is, it's a position that can last for your entire career. There aren't many people that quit that job in Italy. And it's also better paid than the average software developer job in Italy. Working on that, I learned a lot. I had to learn COBOL for once and IBM DB2 databases. They are absolutely useful technologies and stack frames. They are used a lot, at least in this country, like in banks and in the government-owned companies. I was working on retirement pensions, for example. But I then realized that I wanted something different. I wanted to work on, you know, state-of-the-art technology, that I wasn't ready to give up my Java and JavaScript skills, and I wasn't ready to wait maybe 5 years for them to adopt Java instead and deprecate COBOL.
Well, so now I believe somewhere along the line in here, you did decide to go get your PhD. Is that right?
Yes, this was a possibility with INBS. They were supporting people going back to studies and get a PhD.
Were you still thinking about going that academic route at that point? Or was it, hey, because my employer is paying for it, I might as well get one?
Well, actually, my employer was not paying for it. I was living off a scholarship with the university. But they were like supporting, giving me the time to study and giving me a break from work to complete this PhD. It was obviously, it was a little bit of both. Like I wouldn't have minded to have a chance at academia and start maybe my part as later a professor. Also, it seemed like a field. I started my PhD in robotics back then in Pisa, and it seemed like a field where you still had a lot of opportunities to get your hands dirty, right? To collaborate with the industry.
What made you want to leave at that point? You know, I think you had like 2 years in. I'm assuming you kind of did all the coursework and then decided to not do the thesis part?
Yeah, no, I didn't finish it with my coursework. It was a few things. Like it was a particular personal situation. My mother got sick at some point, and I really needed to both be available, be around, and I needed to earn a little bit more than I couldn't afford the student life anymore. And at the same time, I was also like rethinking my choice anyway, because by then I was really into machine learning. And I thought that was the future also for robotics, but the course I was following was not the same. Like they shared more concerns about using machine learning. And some of these concerns were right. For example, they didn't want to use machine learning as black boxes. And I think that was also, like history has proved that this was a valid concern, especially for a field like robotics where there are safety hazards, right? But the path that I would have had to take was not aligned to what I wanted to study and what I wanted to perfect. Like my proposal when I applied for this PhD was evolutionary robotics and bringing this, like studying how you could evolve hardware for the robots and how could robots, you know, cope with not just change the environment, but changes in hardware. Like, for example, for a spider robot coping with a missing limb or a damaged limb. After a while, I realized that I would not have been able to progress in that field or to bring forward my research in that field.
Yeah, no, that makes sense. I mean, it's, you know, life coinciding with a number of different things totally makes sense. And, you know, PhD is a big long-term commitment, so totally understandable there. Hey, Developmenter fans, be sure to check out the new online series of conferences from Manning Publications called Live at Manning. As many of you know, Manning has been a longtime supporter of the show, offering up free books and discounts for our listeners. Now we're teaming up with them as a media sponsor to spread the word on this new conference series. These conferences are free to attend, filled with talks from some really great tech experts, and stream globally via Twitch. No travel needed. Next up in the Live at Manning series is a one-day event focused on math and data science. It is on December 1st, starting at 12 p.m. Eastern. This is your chance to hear from speakers like Brian Godse, Nicole Koningstein, An Lei, and many others. During this show, you'll be able to dive deep on math topics like principal component analysis, linear regression, and probabilistic modeling. Be sure to head over to developmentor.com/manningmath, all one word, to find out more. In case you didn't catch that, there's a link in our show notes. We'll see you there. Now, you know, shifting gears a little bit, I think you're the first person we've had on the show with the title of data visualization engineer, right? So tell me a little bit about what that role is. What did that look like day to day for you?
It was back when I was working for Swift IQ. So they had these, well, they were kind of precursors. They were ahead of the time. They were offering machine learning on demand almost 10 years back. And they had a quite nice platform already. What they needed was like creating visualization, meaningful visualization for their clients to understand, to make sense of all the information that were gathered and that then were processed. So my main job was creating nice, meaningful visualization using mostly JavaScript, D3.js. Then we switched to Angular.js also as a framework. And I think at some point I introduced Reactive.js, which is a framework that was created by Rich Ferris, who later created this Svelte.js, an amazing framework, by the way. Basically, we had this data and then we had to figure out ways to present it to the customer so that they could understand it very easily, to at least get a grasp of how they were doing. Well, depending on the visualization, there were like dashboards which were like more basics. And you could see, I don't know, for example, how sales were going, and you can filter by product or by other criteria. And there were also more complex visualization that were kind of extracting the keys of how they were doing or how the sales were going.
Yeah, I mean, you know, my experience kind of doing data visualization work like that is, you know, there's a lot of really interesting challenges because you often have a lot of data and you then have to ship that over the wire. You have to render it in the browser, kind of figuring out what is the right amount of data to ship, where best to do the computation, all of those kinds of things are some pretty interesting challenges on that front. Was that your experience?
Yeah, absolutely. And then also, like, since we were handling a lot of data, we had also to cope with the framework's limitations. Like, for example, even just querying the data, I think back then it was Google App Engine, which had like 60 seconds timeout for requests. So you couldn't query too much data, or you had to, you know, have workarounds in the first place to shorten it. And the same with the databases. It's decide where you wanted to implement your joins. And like, for example, there were databases back then. I don't know if it's still the case. I don't think so. But back then, some of these NoSQL databases were not allowing joins. So we, at some point, had to try to these joins in the code, which is like 10 times slower or even worse.
Very, very true. I know I've worked on some of those too, where it's like, could you just give me some basic data manipulation tools? I sense kind of coming forward, and I see it, you know, perhaps in this applied research engineer, you know, don't worry, I'm not going to get into what you did at Apple, but, you know, kind of, it seems like as you started to work at Twitter and Microsoft and Apple and some of these bigger companies, like it feels like your work is deepening, right? Like you're getting more into deep algorithms, data structures, you're doing more machine learning. Was this a concerted effort on your part to transform your career? Like, what was going on with Marcello at this time that you decided to start to pursue these kind of, you know, more back-end, deeper, harder roles, if you will?
Yeah, absolutely. I think it was a journey that had several steps. One milestone was around 2011, the end of 2011, 2012, when the first MOOC, the first massive online course started. It was the one about artificial intelligence and machine learning. First, the one that was provided by Sebastian Tran and Peter Norvig. And then also I started with Andrew Young machine learning course. And this is something I would have wanted so much in my earlier career. This was the chance to learn state-of-the-art technologies and to learn from the best in the field online, basically, without any restriction on my location. And I could do this as like outside of my working hours and keeping a job in parallel. Anyway, like when I started learning more, I had studied neural networks actually pretty early, when like during the long AI winter in the early 2000s and then 2007, 2008 with self-organizing mobs, when there was not the right hardware to run neural networks. And so it seemed like impossible to beat the classic computer vision algorithms with neural networks. And then I had let it go a little bit and lost sight of the progress. And with these courses, I started again learning about all the progress in machine learning. And it sounded so exciting. I realized that I missed it and I wanted to, you know, first learn more. And then as my career was progressing, I wanted to focus more on this. And then, you know, SwiftIQ and Twitter were also big steps, because I realized that I could work on something like this. I could work on making sense of data. And then, of course, Twitter was like a major step because of the opportunities that you get in a company like this. And I guess I would say that my engineering mindset also changed after I joined them. Like I had worked already with great engineers and I had tried to learn as much as possible, but really then at Twitter, it was like a different game, many more opportunities. I will always be grateful to my hiring manager back at Twitter and my team there, like for hiring me and for teaching me how to be a better engineer. And at the same time, like how I could work on my skills and on myself to continuously improve and learn.
What is just like maybe one or two quick tips on how something you learned that helped you be a better engineer?
I would say one of the things I struggled the most at the beginning, especially in large companies, is domain knowledge. And at first I thought it was like my fault, like, you know, the imposter syndrome. And at some point, I think many developers get that. When I moved to Twitter, I felt it like very strongly. And I was afraid of asking questions because I thought I would look bad. Instead, like, the best advice I can give you is if you join a new company, like, ask a ton of questions, like, respectfully of other people's work, but maybe schedule meetings and don't get stuck on something when you can just ask. Maybe like try to work it a little bit on your own, and if you are stuck, ask for help, because the chances are people will be happy to help you and to give you a hand. The other advice I could give is to, you know, always question your knowledge. You know, try to listen to what other developers, other people have to say before, you know, getting defensive or starting like to push your point of view or your knowledge. Because maybe like you have a good understanding of something already, but there is something new you can learn, or because maybe the technology changed, or because the context is different. Anyway, like I feel like that discussing things with other engineers is one of the best perks of especially large companies. It's also one of the ways you can learn better from your mistakes and, well, from other people's experience. If you have to defend your point anyway, you will have to understand it thoroughly. If you are on the other side, though, if you are the more experienced developer, I really feel that you should also let junior developers or new developers on the team express their knowledge and let them feel, you know, safe to ask questions or to bring something new to the table. Then you might or might not use the suggestions or not take the different way that is offered by new developers. But one of the worst feelings I had was when in some companies I always felt this from, luckily, a minority of people, but from some people I felt like pushing back on anything new or anything that was different from their knowledge.
Yeah, for sure. I see that a lot in more senior engineers. They just kind of get stuck. You know, they're stuck in the way they're used to doing things. And, you know, it's so sad because technology is all about change and you've got to stay up with the times. Well, speaking of change here, Marcello, let's talk a little bit about your book. You know, you're the author of Algorithms and Data Structures in Action by Manning Publications. What's the book about and who's it for?
Thanks for asking. Yes, it's been a long journey with this book, actually. So I'm quite happy that we are almost ready to the printed version. So it's about, of course, algorithms and data structures. But what we try to do with this book is talking about them and merging, in a way, a theoretical point of view, like something like a textbook, but with really a stress on practical applications for it. So it's a kind of a hybrid. It tries to take the best of both worlds. And I hope, judging from the reviews we got, I hope we managed to do this. Like, my point of view is that you don't need to remember by heart how an algorithm works or be able to write, Dijkstra's algorithm or B-trees from scratch and by heart. You just need to know they exist. You need to understand maybe the basics of how they work, but above all, you need to understand when you can use them to your advantage and to improve the performance or of your applications. If you know they exist and you know where to look, then you will be able to recognize patterns in your applications where, for example, you can say, oh, here I need to, you know, keep this list sorted, but the list of anything like of tasks or inputs anyway that you get, I need to keep it sorted, but it changes dynamically and the rate of reads is much larger than the rate of writes. And then you can understand that maybe a priority queue is a good idea as opposed to, sorting the list from scratch each time. Just to give you as simple as an example that I can think of. There can be also more complex examples. Maybe you manage to recognize optimization problems, or even better, you recognize that some problems cannot be solved efficiently because they are NP-complete problems. And then you need a heuristic to solve them instead of having a the best possible solution, but with an algorithm that takes 3 days to compute it, if you're lucky, 3 days, because with NP-complete problems, it can also happen that you cannot get the right answer in your lifetime on bigger instances, right? No, just wanted to say that, especially from a beginner developer point of view, it's good to know that there are problems that you cannot solve exactly. It's good to know where you have to, when you can spend your resources and your time, and where instead it would be a waste.
Yeah, for sure. No, I love that. I mean, especially trying to make algorithms and data structures a bit more practical. I mean, there's the go off and interview at Facebook and stand up at a whiteboard and talk about how to do merge sort or whatever and what its runtime is, but much more practically in the industry, knowing when and how to use these things is the important thing. I want to pause here, Marcello, and let's do a quick giveaway on the book. The way this works, the first five people who email the show at hello at developmentor.com. That's H-E-L-L-O at developmentor.com. We'll receive a code good for one free ebook. For those of you who don't want to send an email, you can get a 40% discount on all Manning books, including Algorithms and Data Structures in Action, by using the discount code PODDEVMEN20. That's P-O-D-D-E-V-M-E-N 20. And we'll be sure to link all of that up in the show notes. So please do send in. This is a great book, nice practical use of algorithms and data structures. So please do send us an email. All right, back into it. Marcello, why write a book?
Like algorithms, it's been one of my favorite areas of computer science since my time in the university. And I wanted to learn more about some of them and also try my knowledge, try if I was able to, and share my something that I'm really passionate about. I felt that there was a gap in the offer and that we could actually create a nice book that would give you both the experience of a textbook so that you could learn how algorithms work, but also it had practical use, like it would teach you about problems and how to apply algorithms to real world problems.
You know, it's surprising to me because it, you know, like algorithms data structures has been around a long time. People have written a lot of books on it, but you know, finding one of those that actually tries to make them practical is such a great sweet spot. So best of luck in selling that. Marcello, final question for you here on the show. Total softball, where can our listeners buy the book? Where can they get in touch with you? Where can they follow you on social media?
Okay, so the book can be bought on Manning's website. You can follow me on Twitter. It's the one social network I use the most. And feel free to DM me if you have any questions. You can also follow my repositories on GitHub. There is, in particular, one repository for the book where we provide implementations for all the data structures and algorithms in the book in a few different languages, JavaScript, Python, and Java mostly. And the code can be accessed by anyone. The repository is public and anyone can check it.
Yeah, that's fantastic. And for our listeners, we'll be sure to link up Marcello's Twitter and LinkedIn and that GitHub repository, as well as a link to Manning's book in the show notes here. So Marcello, thank you so much for joining me today. I appreciate you taking the time out of your day to share your story and share your book with us.
Thanks to you. It was really nice. I really enjoyed being here. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you for taking the time to listen to the Developmentor podcast. If you like the show, please subscribe on Apple Podcasts or your favorite podcast app. Even better, please leave us a review. If you want to hear older episodes, leave feedback, or sign up to be a guest, please visit us at developmentor.com. If you'd like to support the show, there are three ways you can help out. 1. Make a donation via Patreon. 2. If you're a software engineer looking for your next gig and wanting to practice interviewing, use our referral link to the interviewing.io platform. And 3. Buy your next tech book from Manning Publications using our affiliate link. All of those links can be found at developmentor.com/support-us. That's SUPPORT-US, all one word. Most importantly, if you like this show, please tell your friends. Referrals are the lifeblood of any podcast. Finally, we here at Developmentor hope that each and every episode helps you move one step closer to finding your path.